Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. Fire and water, these are two basic elements that make the boreal ecosystem function. But what happens when climate change increases the rate of fire to the point the forest cannot recover? That's one of the questions fire researcher Dr. Mike Flanagan looked at in his study on climate change for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. And then there's water. What good is a stream if there aren't any fish in it, either because of over-angling or industrial development? Cumulative impacts on fish is the focus for Dr. Mike Sullivan in his work for the Adaptive Management Experiment Team. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. Warm weather brings forest fires, and global warming will bring even more. That's the conclusion of a recent study done for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. And by the years 2040 to 2060, we can expect the prairie grassland to expand and the northern boreal forest will be especially stressed by fire. As it is, about 2.8 million hectares of forested land burns on average every year in Canada. That's about half the size of Nova Scotia. Warm weather and winds dry out the trees and forest litter that fuel the fires. Lightning strikes and human carelessness ignite them. We already see about 9,000 fire starts in a year. Imagine that rate doubling or tripling with climate change. Dr. Mike Flanagan is a senior research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service and project leader of the fire group.
Well, there was two aspects to the study. One part was we looked in the history to see if the past can teach us some lessons about what the future may hold, an analog, if you like. About 6,000 years ago, it was warmer than present day, and maybe an analog to the future warming we're expecting in the coming century. The second aspect was to use general circulation models, which model the future weather and climate for the next 100 years. In this case, we used the Canadian model, and use that to say what will happen to fire activity in the future.
And what did you conclude?
There's two things. Okay. Using the analog studies, we used charcoal evidence taken from cores from lakes, and these can be dated, and these can tell you charcoal infers fire activity in the past. And during this warmer period, 6,000 years ago, most areas of Canada experienced increased fire activity during this warming. Now, there are large regional variations. At the same time, we used a special model that looked at 6,000 years ago, a general circulation model, and it coincided quite nicely with the data from the charcoal. So there was a good coincidence between the data. And so that suggests that the warming in the past, there was more fire. Now, we contrasted that, or rather we compared it with the GCM that looked 50 years and 100 years in the future, and it says the fire weather is going to be more conducive to fire. So there's going to be more intense fires, there's going to be more area burned. That's what it's suggesting for most of Canada, not all of Canada. There are regional variations. There are parts of Quebec that there were indications that there's going to be less fire in the future. This is because some models suggest there's more precipitation.
General circulation model, what is that actually?
It's a complex atmospheric model. It includes the ocean as well, I should point out. Our weather forecasts that we get every day are run by models that mimic the atmosphere. They're second-order differential equations, and there's six of them, and they solve them. And they can't solve them analytically, so they solve them numerically. And these are the same sorts of models that we use to project into the future. They're very complex. They're not exactly the same as our day-to-day weather forecast models that we get our 1 to 7 day forecast from, but they're similar concepts, and they produce output at grid points across the globe, very coarse resolution, most of them about 300 or 400 kilometers between grid points, but they give you temperature, wind speed, humidity, precipitation every 12 hours, or more frequently, depending on the model, for the next 100 years.
If you go back 6,000 years ago, when you were looking at these charcoal samples, what was the country like at that time? How did it differ from what we see today?
The forests were a little farther north than they currently are today. The grasslands were a little farther north in Alberta and Manitoba. But the boreal forest's composition was much the same as it is today. And the day-to-day weather was very similar to what we experienced. Hot, dry weather one day, and then cold front passes, and you get cold, coolish showers. So it wasn't much different than we experience today.
What would have accounted at that time for the warmer weather, the climate change at that time?
Well, there are several factors that influence the climate. Orbital factors, the Earth's orbit changes, and some believe this is quite critical and was the reason why we were warmer 6,000 years ago. Now, there's three facets to the Earth's orbit. There's a precession of equinoxes. Right now, what that means is where the sun is in relationship to where the Earth is in July and January. Right now, the sun is closest to us in December, but 11,000 years ago, it was closest in July. That's called the precession of equinoxes. Also, the Earth's axis tilts between about 21.5 degrees and 24.5 degrees. And the last factor is the eccentricity of the Earth's orbit. It goes from almost a circle to an ellipse, which is close to an ellipse of different major axes and minor axes. And each of these has different cycles. One's about 11,000, one's about 20,000, one's about 100,000. And so they superimpose. This chap named Milankovitch developed this theory. And this and other factors influence the climate. So given those factors, about 6,000 years ago, we were about a degree warmer than present day in Canada. Now, this is different than what we expect to happen in the future. We're expecting a warming, and we've experienced a warming the last 40 years over most of North America, and in particular this part of the world, North Central, Alberta, Northwest Territories, experienced a warming of over 1 degree already in the last 30 years. But the warming in the future, getting back to the question, is due to changes in atmospheric composition. We have more carbon dioxide, more methane, nitrous oxide, so-called greenhouse gases. And what happens is, these gases allow solar radiation to enter, hit the ground, warm the Earth, but when the radiation from the Earth tries to leave, it traps the heat. It's opaque to those frequency, the long wave frequency. The sun is about 6,000 degrees Celsius, so most of its energy in the wavelengths is in the visible range, which is around 1 micron, just under 1 micron. But when the Earth re-radiates at a temperature of about 290 K, the wavelength is around 11 microns in that area. It's a broad spectrum, but the bulk of it's much, much higher wavelength. So some of these gases are opaque at the higher wavelengths, the terrestrial radiation being re-radiated by Earth, but are transparent to the incoming solar. So thus they're called, the so-called greenhouse gases. And that's why the Earth may warm in the future. So there are different mechanisms for the warming, but I think the key here is it was warmer in the past, there was more fire. In the future, it's going to be warmer, and we expect more fire.
When you look at the analysis that you've done for the study, how far in the future are we looking?
Well, there have been studies that already show that there is a trend in area burned, and it's significant and it's positive, which means we're getting more fire. And if you do a running average of our record since the 1920s, there was a lot of fire in the 30s and 40s, and then it got very quiet, okay? And area burned dropped to an average of about 1 million hectares. Then in the late 70s, fire picked up to where we are now, to about 2.8 million hectares. So it's almost increased, using a running average, a 5 or 10 year running average, we've almost had a threefold increase already. But the problem here is that there's so much year to year variability, it's really hard to say much because fire is so variable and it's so dependent on the weather, which changes all the time, as you know.
What does this hold for us down the road?
Well, my best guess, and I'll say guess, okay, is that most of Canada is going to have more fire, more area burned, the fires are going to be more intense. Our fire season is going to be longer because it's going to be warmer in the spring and in the fall, so it'll extend the fire season. So it's going to put a strain on fire management agencies because there will be more fire, and there will also be considerations for the logging industry, harvesting. If there's more fire and you're competing for fiber, it's going to be a concern.
The work that you've done here, how does that fit into the bigger picture?
The Sustainable Forest Management has been very supportive of our work in fire and climate change. There's been other supports like the Climate Change Action Fund. And we've looked at fire and climate change not only in Canada, but within looking at a global context. We're modeling fires on the landscape, and we're trying to get a better handle of how much area burned we can expect. And recent work suggests that area burn could increase 50 to 100% in the next 50 to 100 years. So if we're running around 2.8 million, we could be seeing, 4 to 6 million hectares burned annually. So, this is a significant increase. But we're working on models to better refine that. And we're also looking at areas in Canada that are vulnerable to fire and perhaps catastrophic change. The forest is quite resilient and adaptable, but perhaps there's some thresholds here, and perhaps there's some surprises that are going to catch us totally off guard.
Any idea of where those catastrophic changes might take place?
They're in areas where perhaps fire is not normal, the Pacific Coast, and other areas where fire becomes so frequent that the forest cannot sustain itself. We have a number of species in our arboreal forest that are used to fire. Okay, not only do they survive, but they actually thrive in fire, and they need fire. Okay, otherwise, if there was no fire, they'd disappear. But at some point, if fire is too frequent, the trees don't reach sexual maturity, and they can't reproduce, or they just have no energy reserves for trees that sucker, like aspen. So it gets converted into grassland. And so if some of these models are correct and we see a severe fire environment, we may indeed see some parts of the forest switching over to more of a grassland. Areas where this may happen may be the prairie provinces.
Thank you very much, Mike.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was Dr. Mike Flanagan. He's a senior research scientist with the Canadian Forest Service and project leader of the fire group in Sault Ste. Marie. He's also involved in climate change research with the Sustainable Forest Management Network. Thank you. The song we just heard is one of my musical interpretations of forest life, a little conceptualized biodiversity mixed with synthesized machinery. And that's really what it comes down to, people and forests. The crucial point for a sustainable future is that we simply must find ways to coexist, to lighten the human footprint. Fish are particularly vulnerable to pressure from angling and industrial development. One scientist searching for new ways to deal with this issue is Dr. Mike Sullivan. He's the Provincial Fish Science Specialist for Alberta Sustainable Resource Development. He's also a member of the AIM team, a dozen independent researchers involved in what they call the Adaptive Management Experiment.
Yeah, that's an interesting group of folks, folks from university, from private sector, from other groups of academia, that really were looking at long-term sustainability of the boreal forest, both industry in the boreal forest, how can forestry, oil and gas coexist with the natural denizens, the fish, wildlife, plants of the boreal forest? How can we have a long-term sustainability? So this is a group of like-minded people interested in science, interested in science-based decision-making, and also concerned about long-term sustainability.
How does fish fit into that?
Well, fish are ubiquitous in the boreal forest. We have grayling in the streams, we have walleye and pike in the lakes, and that's really what draws a lot of people to the boreal forest other than the industrial users. People know northern Alberta as a place to go for fishing. Lakeland is popular for walleye, pike fishing, perch fishing in the wintertime. So a lot of people know the boreal forest for its fish resources. These animals are fairly vulnerable to industrial activity, to overharvest. They're adapted to very cold conditions. They have slow growth, late maturity. They're already on the edge of their range in a lot of cases. We're a long ways north in Alberta, and fish can't take a lot of additional pressure. So in one sense, additional pressure will make the fish react in ways that we can identify, yeah, we're having an effect on sustainability of the boreal. So fish are almost like the canary in the coal mine, a good indicator species for a lot of effects of humans on the boreal.
Can you give me some examples of where fish have shown this vulnerability to access once people start moving into an area, whether it's through forestry operations or oil and gas, or just the fact that people follow afterwards in order to go fishing because their favorite lake is open or they've discovered a new favorite lake?
Yeah, a really good example of that seems to be Arctic grayling. We have studies, or we have surveys of people. We go to places like Athabasca, Cold Lake, and we talk to old-timers and say, what was fishing like back in the 1930s, 40s, 50s? What have you noticed differences? And a common thing we hear from many people is the grayling fishing used to be good. It was really good when access was tough. The ex-director of fisheries in Alberta, Martin Pates, talks about going up on the Christina River back in the 1960s and making a CBC film showing how good the fishing was in northern Alberta. His quote was, he stood in one place and in 1 hour caught 33 fish all over an inch. And yet he also said 20 years later he went back to the same spot and fished for 3 days, he and a partner, and only caught one fish over the 12 inches, the large fish they had caught before, that there had been a massive decrease in the quality of fishing in that time. And that's a common theme we hear. The fishing was really good before the road went in. Oh, the fish were great big when you had to really fight to get in here. When you could walk in, the fishing was good. Once that first cut line or trail went in, then fishing started to decline. That's axiomatic. Anglers repeatedly tell us this story. And that seems to be a common theme, especially for Arctic grayling throughout northern Alberta.
As access opens up, what really is to blame for the decline in the fish?
That's a really good question, and that is the crux of what the scientists of the AIM group want to investigate. We know that when roads go in, fishing goes down. Any angler will tell you that. That really can be broken down into two aspects. Roads can cause some habitat loss. We have culverts under the roads create fragmentation of the streams. Fish can't sometimes swim through culverts if the culverts are improperly installed or a big flood comes through and the culvert is damaged, creates a little waterfall, the fish can't get up. That could cause loss of fish habitat and loss of the fish. Roads improperly constructed can have a lot of silt coming down the ditches and flowing into the streams. So we have habitat loss that has been documented at a few of these sites because of roads, and roads bring people, and people fish, and dead fish result. So that could also be the cause of the fish decline. And that's a real important question. If roads cause fish decline, as anglers tell us they do, what's causing that? Is it habitat loss, or is it excessive fishing pressure? So as part of the AIM group, we're very interested in a new way of learning called adaptive management. And we would like to apply that new way of learning, that science of adaptive management, to answering that question. What's causing the fish decline that anglers complain about? Is it the foot, people, or is it the footprint, the road itself, and habitat loss?
How would you go about studying that?
Well, in a classic sense of science, you would have a control area, a small study site where you don't have roads, you don't have access or the habitat loss or fishing pressure versus habitat loss. You wouldn't have that. You would have one study site that would have habitat loss and all the permutations of those two things. The problem with that is, in a small experiment, you don't have the broad changes we see in ecosystems throughout the boreal forest. We may have drought conditions, we may have flood conditions, we may have anglers moving around. The classic small-scale experiment doesn't control or doesn't allow us to see the effects of those other variables. Adaptive management is a way of translating those small-scale experiments that university research traditionally do into large landscape-style experiments that give us results through what's known as meaningful space, big areas, and meaningful time, years if not decades of study results. In that sense, you do two things. One is you find out the scientific answer to the question, but you also demonstrate the techniques to industry, to people, because you can point to whole watersheds. You can say, okay, on the Moose River watershed, we tried that experiment. We just had roads with some habitat damage, but we didn't have heavy angling pressure. And look, the grayling came back in that big watershed. You can point to those examples rather than say, well, in this small, 200-meter study stretch, the grayling came back. It's much more translatable into policy if you do it on a large, meaningful time and space scale.
Do you have anything in mind yet, or some money behind you to get something like this going?
Well, it's interesting. In the boreal forest, a lot of people are very interested in looking at these questions, and we have groups that are interested in recovering their local stream. We see this on the Tuwatin River and on the Beaver Lodge River. We have federal and provincial levels of government looking at habitat loss or managing the fish. There's lots of different projects out there. Each of the industries, for example, ALPAC is very interested in finding ways to have a lighter footprint on the land. The objective of the AIM team would be to coordinate all of these efforts so that everybody is working in a consistent manner, that it's applied in the framework of a scientific experiment. So after a decade of everybody doing their individual projects, we're actually have advanced our knowledge. We know something different. We've answered our questions after 10 years rather than sort of piecemeal projects throughout the boreal forest. So that's the main goal, is not creating new studies, new projects out there, but coordinating the existing projects that people really want to do. People want to do habitat enhancement. Can we fix this stream? Can we have a lighter footprint? Can we bring grayling back to this stream? The AIM group would say, can we do it in a coordinated manner so after 10 years we have a better idea? Was it the foot or was it the footprint that caused the fish decline, and consequently, by reducing that, caused, hopefully, the fish recovery?
Why is it important to do that?
If we don't do it, we don't have the demonstration projects to say, see, it worked on this large scale. If we just use a small, sort of a classic university experiment, industry could say, well, we can't really do that on a big scale. We can't have forestry and oil and gas creating these conditions of habitat enhancement like you did on your small study area. If we, as scientists, force ourselves to work over large time and space scales, we also force our solutions to be practical. We can't just say, okay, we want this stream to be completely untouched. That's not going to happen. I mean, we have industrial development in Alberta. That is a fact of life. The forest companies, oil and gas companies, want to have a lighter footprint in areas. So we can say, well, what's the best you can do? What's the most ecologically sound manner that you can work on this stream within your guidelines, within your parameters of economic sustainability. In that sense, science matches what can be done socially, what can be done economically. It's very different from the classic university experiments.
What do you see or what do you want to see as the outcome of all of this?
Well, what I want to see is an increased science-based understanding of what's happening in the boreal forest. And we do have clues as to what will likely happen based on other studies that have been done in other areas. And a probable outcome, what looks like maybe the most likely outcome for the adaptive management experiment would be something along the lines of when access is newly created into an area, if an oil and gas company is going to punch a road into a new watershed, we may have strong restrictions on the grayling harvest. That would keep the fish populations very healthy. The oil company would then have a certain set of light ecological footprint rules, large culverts, diverting runoff from their ditches away into forests so the silt doesn't get into it, trying to use bridges, winter work only, things that fit within their economic framework for working near a stream. And then if by chance an accident happens, a bridge fails, we do have a silt load, or a culvert does fail after a storm, and the fish population is still healthy because the angling pressure hasn't reduced it, then the fish population can recover quickly from that industrial accident. So it's likely a combination of when an industry is in an area, back off on the harvest pressure to make the fishes more resilient to any accidents that might happen, and industry also has a lighter ecological footprint. We still have fishing, we still have industrial activity in the forest, but the fish populations will be healthier and more resilient to any accidents that happen and can recover very quickly.
Thank you very much, Mike.
You're welcome.
That was Dr. Mike Sullivan, Provincial Fish Science Specialist with Alberta Sustainable Resource Development and a member of the Adaptive Management Experiment Team. Mike is also the author of a new book from Lone Pine. It's called Fish of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Sustainable Forest Management Network, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, the Capital Region Innovation Center, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, Alberta Conservation Association, Alberta Research Council, the University of Lethbridge, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.